Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle.
So I saw Immortals about 6 months ago.
Really? Is that how long it was? Really, because I saw it on Friday.
Oh, really? Wow, what a surprise.
What'd you think?
Actually, I didn't like it much at all. I thought it was really boring, honestly.
Better or worse than 300?
Worse. It was kind of like they took the cool bits of 300 and said, wow, these are really cool bits, and they tried to make an entire movie out of just action scenes and stop slow motion.
Wasn't that 300, though? I mean, I like that movie, but wasn't that 300? You're describing 300 to me.
You took out that massive political subplot in 300. The love story was gone.
Right.
No, what are you talking about, dude?
It was all fighting.
It's weird, this thing. When I'm not watching 300, I always feel like, oh, I love that movie. I want to watch it again. But when I am watching it, I kind of get bored of it. But, yeah. No, but The Immortals, like, I was ready to turn it off halfway through. It just wasn't catching my interest.
Hmm. Had you seen the movie The Cell?
That Jennifer Lopez way back when?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, yes.
And Vincent D'Onofrio?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's the same director.
Okay.
So he said he wanted to make Immortals the Fight Club meets that artist, Caravaggio.
Mm-hmm.
So, and, like, yeah, it's like, I thought The Immortals was the same as The Cell. It's not that you would think The Cell was the greatest psychological thriller you'd ever seen, but he's got a real way with the imagery and the costumes. And
the costuming was really good, yes.
And the production, so that it elevates the movie. And I thought the same with Immortals, in that I say probably better comparison would be Clash of the Titans. It's not as if the acting was particularly outstanding or the story was particularly revolutionary, but, you know, the costumes and the way he shoots things, the sets, all of that, I think, elevates it.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually was interested from start to finish. I didn't get that it was Greek at first. I was like, oh, he's kind of making his own his own mythology. Okay, well done. And I'm like, oh, is this Greek? Oh. All right.
Yeah, you're right. Like, the production value was very good on it. The costumes were nice. The action was nice. I mean, it was a very pretty movie, but
it's artistic.
Yeah. It was also kind of dumb. Like, there were several points throughout the movie at which the plot could have been very easily resolved by any number of different characters, and it just kind of never was.
So they were kind of like unbelievable problems.
Yeah, I mean, like, they had reasons for it. For example, like, you know, Zeus being the all-powerful god, he could have come down and trounced the bad guys from square one, but he was really prideful and he didn't want to interfere in the affairs of humans, even if they were going particularly bad. But it was to the point where, like, the things that were going so bad that it's kind of just stupid to not interfere. So it wasn't a believable amount of resistance.
Yeah, I mean, I thought those were, like, flaws and, like, myths, though. You know, you're like, why don't you just, not to reveal anything, but why didn't you just destroy X to begin with?
Yeah.
If X could do this. And then you're like, exactly. Well, because of the myths, they never did that. It was always like, oh, and it gets loose, you know? Mm-hmm. You have this box with all the evils in the world. Why don't you just, like, put the box somewhere nobody can find it or destroy it?
Make one of those unbreakable chains around
it. Because they have to explain why there's evil in the world. So, of course, the box gets
opened. Right, exactly. Yeah. And it's the same as, like, you know, why did this happen? You're like, well, da-da-da-da-da.
Because it's not an interesting story if it doesn't. How about that?
Yeah. And I also saw a Tower Heist over the weekend with Ben Stiller and Eddie Murphy.
Never even heard of that.
Any good?
It was a lot better than I expected. It was, I felt like watching a comedy. I hadn't seen one in a while. And, it was alright. Kept my interest throughout. It's one of those comedies that kind of keeps your interest as a movie as opposed to makes you, you know, bust a gut laughing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Which is good, so you can watch it more than once rather than dying.
Oh, no, I don't. I wouldn't say that. No. Please don't go out and buy Tower Heist. Oh, I got the director's cut, the ultimate edition, with the making of. Curse you, Lyle.
Lyle!
I didn't recommend. That, guys. So that was my weekend.
And also check out Immortals.
I would. I mean, I'm not sure it would give you, for example, if you're going to use it for like game ideas, you get many game ideas.
Absolutely.
How to set up combat. How about that?
Nothing with the story was anything you haven't seen before. Mm-hmm. You know what I would say that you could get out of it is just when you're trying to establish a really amazing or outlandish place, is just ignore any kind of ecology or semblance of
physics.
So like a standard D&D setting.
Yeah, no, I guess so. Yeah, it'd be like the ecology of a dungeon and just people like just random monsters sitting in the room.
Yeah.
It's almost as if they built the entire economy and the geopolitical structure of this world on this, like, oh, this town is on like a cliff and there's absolutely nothing around. Like, there's actually, it's at the beginning. He's the hero is chopping wood. And I was thinking, where do you get that tree from? There's absolutely no trees anywhere. And then I was like, really, should you just be like cutting that up? You probably should like preserve that. Should they be celebrating the existence of this one tree?
Plant that stuff, man.
Perhaps that was the last tree he chopped down.
Yeah, it's like, you might want to do more than just like kind of have this another conversation. You should be talking about the tree.
I have this image now of watching Immortals and the Lorax pops out of the trees chopping. None of you are familiar with that Dr. Seuss book, I Am the Lorax, I Speak for the Trees.
Oh, yeah, I know it.
Hopefully there's someone listening to this who laughed at that. It's coming out as a movie this year.
You don't want to do one of those like trust tests with Chris, eh? Oh, it's like, I'm going to fall back and, oh, poof. You're supposed to catch me. Oh, yeah, I knew that.
Yeah, I knew.
Jeez, yeah.
Now, I reckon if you were going to do a Planescape game, it would probably be really good to kind of get you in the mood or to give you an idea how to establish a mood for that and some window dressing.
Yep.
Planescape, so everything's half demon or half angel?
Pretty much, yeah.
Wayne, if you do go and watch it, I maybe recommend watching it in parts. Watch a quarter and then go eat lunch and then watch another quarter.
It's less than 2 hours.
Yeah, so 15-minute chunks is probably good.
Now,
so, Chris, I'm guessing you're not a rip the Band-Aid off in one go kind of guy, then.
Not when the Band-Aid is this movie, no.
Oh, geez, all right.
Ouch.
I thought I usually panned movies.
I don't know. I don't actually know what that metaphor means.
So the most recent Dragon's Eye View article came out, and I don't know. I thought it was kind of timely because it was about ghosts, wraiths, and specters, and just kind of coincidence that our last episode was about ghosts, so
yes.
I thought that was kind of funny. Perhaps they listened to our podcast. Yeah.
Well, the other one was about the mummy, mummy's curses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe they do. Yeah.
But did they talk about curses?
In the mummy one, they did,
There was a mummy one?
Yes. Oh. Sorry, the previous article by James Wyatt was about mummies and liches, and this new one by John Shindahite was about, the incorporeal.
The ancient dead. Oh, now I get it.
Yeah. Yes, see, it makes sense.
Yeah, I didn't click on it.
Yeah.
I was like, more.
It's honestly not all that interesting. It's both of them are, here's our ideas for the monsters. What do you think? Are we doing a good job? Do you like them?
It's their usual thing.
Yeah, exactly, their usual thing. But, I don't know, I was talking with Chris before the episode, because in the art article, they're asking for how they can visually represent these different ghost undead, ghosts, specters, and wraiths. And I don't know, Chris, I think you had a good point of...
Well, in their defense, it was a rhetorical question saying, isn't it really hard to differentiate between the looks of ghosts and spirits and specters and everything? But yeah, I was saying that there really isn't a difference to it. I mean, colloquially, we use ghost, spirit, specter, whatever in the language as just different words for the same general class of creatures. I mean, we had a tough time with the ghost episode defining it. So if D&D is going to draw these artificial separations between what is a ghost, what is a specter, etc., then really it's just they can't draw lines between what they look like. They might as well just come up to it. Asking the audience isn't gonna matter.
Yeah, as you said, it was a rhetorical question. And then later on in the article, they said, oh, we're thinking of this for ghosts. We're thinking of that for race. And we're thinking of this other thing for specters. Do you like what we're doing,
I mean, I think their definition is fine. Like, what was it you said? A ghost is kind of like a sorrowful spirit and a specter's a vengeful one or something like that?
Yeah, I think they said they're going to have ghosts be, sorrowful or lost. Specters, are going to be, murder victims and, kind of vengeful. And then they said wraiths would be like guardian spirits of kind of like tombs or places, which didn't really make all that sense, because when I hear the word wraith, I think of something pretty evil.
I would have put that one as the specter one.
Yeah. No, they're thinking of like barrel wraiths.
Yeah, yeah.
Must be, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that's fine. Great. Those definitions are fantastic. But, I mean, then draw ghosts looking sorrowful. Go for it, you know?
Yeah.
Yep.
Good point, Lau. Good point.
You took my point, dude.
Yes, I did.
So one of the other things I thought was interesting was that he had a quote in, you know, discussing how these incorporeal undead should look. And he said that as a player, he wants to be able to tell the difference between these monsters on sight. And he shouldn't have to rely on the DM or the GM telling him that something is either a ghost or a specter or a wraith. And I don't know, I thought that was kind of odd, because as you brought up before, Chris, part of the fun of a game is mystery. You know, and the way to make things interesting and kind of tense is to provide some kind of mystery. And if one of the three pillars of the D&D experience they're holding up all the time is exploration, it kind of seems to, in my opinion, to kill that. Like, wouldn't you kind of want to explore finding out what this thing is rather than just being able to tell on sight, oh, that's a wraith, or oh, that's a specter?
I kind of read it in a different light. I got the feeling that he was saying that he doesn't want the DM to say, this is a ghost, this is a specter. He wants there, for example, if players walk into a room and there's one ghost and one specter floating there, that by the descriptions alone, the players would be able to tell that they are different creatures.
Okay. Being able to tell they're different creatures, I guess that's fine if they're going to do different things, you know, in the mechanically in the game.
Yeah,
but and maybe that's in the way a game I saw sense. It. Yeah. In a game sense, if they know, like, that a ghost is a sorrowful spirit, and then this creature in front of them looks sorrowful, then they might be able to deduce it's a ghost without being told that. So I actually see it in a pretty positive light. I think that's what he was saying.
Yeah, you can still have mystery. I mean, if you want to have, let's say, if you have a white dragon, you can describe the dragon. If it's the first time somebody's encountered a dragon at all, or a white dragon, then, yeah, you would play up, you know, how huge it was, and the kind of cold feeling you have.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're like, oh, you know, maybe in, out of character, they're like, oh, great, it's a white dragon, but then they're the players or the characters are like, oh, I don't know what this is. It's some sort of dragon, you know.
Possibly white. Mm.
Yeah, but
could it be a white dragon?
But if the game master goes, okay, you see a white dragon, okay, your characters don't know what a white dragon is, but it's like it's a giant lizard, you know what I mean? Then it's kind of, that's actually ruined the mystery.
Right.
So.
No, it's a good point.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of looked at it a little bit negative, but I can see. come on.
What a surprise.
Yeah, exactly. What a surprise. But I guess my last question is, would the players know the difference between these spirit undead, or would the characters know? You know, like, how easy is that to know in the game world? Depends on it. And
yeah. Otherwise, you kind of investigators, they might know then.
Yeah, exactly. Ooh, fantasy paranormal investigators. Hey, fantasy X-Files. That actually could be kind of cool. So, song was that?
Ghostbusters.
All right.
Come on.
I still had X-Files in my brain, and I'm like, that wasn't X-Files. All right. But
had a little upbeat.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you know who wrote a book about dragons, or a dragon, or at least an eye of the dragon, was Stephen King.
I would have guessed J.K. Rowling, but okay.
Yeah. Well, we're not talking about Rollins today, we're talking about Stephen King.
Yeah. So.
Well, at least Chris has got
J.K. Rowling's? Boo.
Well, let's not start the hate, dude. So, in our month of horror, to continue the tradition of having a literature lesson, so last year we did H.P. Lovecraft, and this year we're going to do Stephen King, and it coincidentally, or maybe not so coincidentally, H.P. Lovecraft was one of Stephen King's major influences.
Mm-hmm.
The other was Richard Matheson. He wrote I Am Legend. Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. All right. So what we're going to do, just like the other literature lessons, we've pulled out some themes from Stephen King's horror books. Of course, he's written other books as well. And these are not the definitive themes. These are just things that we thought were particularly interesting or things that you can use in a game. I'm sure everybody knows who Stephen King is, but just to provide a little bit of background, he's from Maine, which is large. Reason why a lot of his books are set in Maine. And as we said before, he was influenced by H.P. Lovecraft. He found a collection of short stories from his father, who left when he was like a little boy. But he also cites like EC Comics, you know, Tales from the Crypt, as well as Richard Matheson as being major influences on his work. So, you know, well, that's probably all you need to know about Stephen King. I mean, he had a traumatic childhood experience, so I think that might be important as we talk about one of the themes, where I guess he saw one of his friends die, and then he blocked that memory. It was so traumatic, so he came back speechless, and then he found out a couple of days later that one of his friends got hit by a train.
Yeah, that'll have an effect on you.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. He also had a substance abuse problem, so you also see that appear in some of his books. He also had a quasi-famous pseudonym of Richard Bachman. Yeah, he wrote some really good stories under that pseudonym. And that was him trying to test to see if people would like the stories for what they were, not just because of his name.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty cool. Like, was I just lucky or am I actually that good?
Yeah.
Well, put it that way, so it sounds a little bit conceited. Oh, no, I am that good. Wow.
No, turns out that's the case.
Yeah.
And another cool thing about Stephen King is when he mentions his wife, he always mentions that she is also a writer.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we don't talk a lot about Tabitha King as a writer. Because he's clearly the more successful one of the two.
Mm-hmm.
But that's always kind of stood out as being something pretty neat. Oh, and he also supports radio stations, local radio stations, and loses money on them. Or not supports, but he buys them and runs them.
Hmm.
And takes a bath.
Guess he can afford to, huh?
Yeah.
We should call him.
Yes.
Okay, but we're not radio, dude.
Well, he's not going to know that.
We could be.
If we had Stephen King money backing us.
I don't know, I get the impression that he might find us. I kind of get the feeling he's a guy who Googles himself a lot.
Ah, well, maybe after this episode drops, yeah.
All right. Well, we should just tag him in every episode then.
Yeah.
Should probably cut out that thing about him Googling himself a lot then, huh?
Yeah. Only flattering stuff. Okay, so for the first theme, and this is certainly something that struck me when I first started reading his books, is the sense of realism. And actually, when we talked about this as a theme, we all had slightly different interpretations of what it means, so... my interpretation of this kind of realistic theme that I think can really help a game is it's almost like the Holden Caulfield, the J.D. Salinger thing, where when you read Catcher in the Rye, and you're like, hey, this kid kind of thinks like me. You know, if you're a teenager and you read Catcher in the Rye, yeah, it does speak to you because of the way he thinks. His insecurities are the same insecurities you have.
Mm.
And it's the same with the characters. He makes them by giving you a little insight into what they're thinking and their insecurities and their mundane problems. And you're like, well, I have those same problems. You know, it draws you into the story that much more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And it grounds the story and you relate to the characters a lot more. So I think he's got a real knack and the dialogue is real.
Mm-hmm.
Like those conversations that those people have, you know, are conversations that you can imagine yourself having, you know, if there was a rabid dog outside your car.
If you were in that situation, you'd be having that same conversation.
Yeah, I was just saying, if I had a dog, I would scream the exact same way.
Rabid. Yeah. Wow. No, I think that's a good point. And what you said about being able to identify more with the character, arguably that makes the stories more horrific, you know, because I guess you identify strongly with the character. You can see yourself in, you know, that character's shoes, and arguably that makes it scarier, or at least more tense.
Yeah, that's the big thing that I got out of this idea of realism. Is I know this sounds absolutely stupid, but the characters are very real. You can see yourself as them often, and that, yeah, just like you said, Wayne, it brings you into the story, makes you part of it, and makes it scarier.
When I looked at realism, I kind of, as you said, Lyle, took it differently, where the story isn't really supernatural, or not overtly supernatural. And again, arguably, I think things that are realistic and real are, I guess, oftentimes more gruesome or more horrific than things that are obviously supernatural or you know, fantasy. There's that saying, the truth is stranger than fiction. Well, I think you could also say that the truth is often more horrific than fiction. So making things seem realistic and keeping the characters realistic and, you know, not straying off into, I guess, H.P. Lovecraft territory or other kind of supernatural territory
Well, makes he does more... go in that direction, though, quite often. His stories very often have a supernatural component to them. But your greater point is absolutely right, that they aren't very fantastic. You can very easily imagine this as taking place in the real world, even if it's about demons or dragons or some kind of strange monsters.
Yeah, I mean, even like when you take something like The Stand, and that was his way of like doing Lord of the Rings, but set in an American setting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, yeah, kind of his approach to a lot of his... Like, he's the one, like, in Christine, you got a ghost car.
Mm.
You know, there's no ghost ship, or there's no ghost monster, or, you know, a ghost god, you know, forgotten god, or anything like that. It's just like, here's a sweet car, and, oh yeah, but it's killing people. All right. Let's see what we can do with that.
Hey, it kills a lot more people. All right, where do we keep going? And it kills more people. All right.
Yeah.
But couldn't you kind of arguably say that the supernatural is toned down in most of his work, though? As you said, it's not anything giantly overt.
It's not like, flat. It's not as flashy as some other horror movies might be. But.
I mean, his first book was like that he released was Salem's Lot, and that's like a town of vampires.
Ah, that's true.
Yeah,
that's true.
I think it depends. I mean, like Cujo is like a rabid dog, and you're like, wow, a whole book on a rabid dog. We mentioned in an earlier episode this month that you know, there's Thinner. That's actually one of the Bachman books, but. And that's about a curse. Where the person that, if you look at our position map, it would be very realistic, where you're just constantly losing weight, much like a lot of diseases.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So yeah, it does depend, but I think people do like it when it is kind of a little more realistic or grittier. Like, it's only like, if you take like, there's different steps, like, yeah, Lovecraft was way out there. I mean, he had like a whole different cosmology and they were gods, you know, there's so many steps away.
Mm-hmm.
But his was like more like the Pikmin model, maybe.
Right.
It's just like the degeneration or something like that. And then he just kind of goes with that one step away from reality and sees what he can do with that. But like,
behind the curtain.
But like, it is like a classic monster.
Mm, that's true.
Yeah. I think a lot of it is that the character's reactions to it are also very realistic. For example, like Tommyknockers, I mean, it's more science fiction than it is supernatural. But, you know, the main character, he's dealing with all of these strange technologies and all these weird creatures around, and his reaction is to go and get a gun.
Mm.
And what else are you going to do?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Maybe I was thinking because the short story I read called 1922, it's told from first-person perspective about a guy who murders his wife. And that's not a spoiler, because it's the second sentence of the story. And because it's being told first person, you know, we know this guy's thoughts, and we can kind of see him doubting whether things are actually happening or whether they're in his imagination. At the beginning, you know, he kind of says, oh, this is only my imagination, and I know it's my imagination, but that doesn't stop me from thinking it might possibly be something else. You know, and you, the reader, you kind of don't know along with the character. You're like, well, it seems like everything is, able to be explained away rationally, but because of what happened in the story and because of what this guy did, he's kind of doubting himself, and now I am too, but everything could actually be happening. There could be a plausible explanation for everything that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I kind of took the realism and why, you know, kind of real life can be much more horrific than fantasy.
Yeah.
I think one way you can introduce the realism in a story, of course you could have a very realistic story, I mean, that goes without saying, but it's just the kind of dialogue you have and the kind of motivations that you provide to your player character, but also to your NPCs if you're running the game. You know, sometimes you try to make them too fantastic, but even in a fantastic setting, the person might have some pretty relatable goals, relatable insecurities, relatable motivations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, because like, as you said, the reason you identify with the characters is because they seem real. So as you said, like, even in like a fantasy setting or a setting with, you know, superpowers or whatever, especially the NPCs, if they don't, I would argue, if they don't feel real, then you're going to have a harder time getting the players to care about them, which is what would make an interesting and compelling horror story.
Well, I think your point there, Lyle, is really good, that people have more than one motivation, and a lot of our motivations are very base, natural, or very mundane. If you have your NPCs and, you know, say this one NPC, his motivation is that his goal is that he wants to take over the kingdom. But, you know, also his other motivations is maybe he wants to find a date, or, you know, maybe he wants revenge on another guy. They're very, very standardized things, but they can do a lot to bring him more, bring him into a realistic light. You know, that's the way he acts, is towards this certain person or against other people.
It'd be much easier for him to get a date after he controls the kingdom.
This is true. This is true. Maybe that's why that's his big goal. But it can be having those kinds of very realistic motivations can give you a lot of leeway, so you can very naturally direct how your NPCs act towards the PCs.
Yeah, and also just the kind of, like, the way they speak. I guess even when you're doing certain things like science fiction or fantasy, you might be tempted to, like...
Dost thou go in
there? Yeah, I suppose, you know, Thor it up a bit.
Thor it up.
And we have encouraged people to do that in past episodes, is to try to, like, transport people into another world. But sometimes you might want to opt to just kind of keep things really real and really modern, just so the players get caught up more in the story.
Mm. Yeah, it is much easier to relate to the NPCs if they're speaking in a language that you can easily understand and speak back, even if it is a fantastic setting.
To just clarify, are you suggesting that the DM or GM speak in contemporary language with the players, despite the setting, so that they kind of don't have to, I don't know, get past an accent?
The king looks at you and says, "Dude!"
I didn't mean that.
No, it could, it could backfire. Obviously, you should match it to the best thing to do is to match it to the setting. Like, for example, you know, if you read The Body, or which became the movie Stand By Me, they're using, like, the kid slang of the time.
Right.
And that, by all means, is the best way to go. You know, that's what we've done in some stories, like when we did, like, a story set in the 60s, is picking up some slang and using that.
Right.
But I guess what I'm saying is don't err too far on the side or, you know, I guess the simple and very obvious advice I'm giving is, like, let the dialogue work for you. Don't let it work against you. And sometimes it can create a barrier to the story. So if you're doing a fantasy episode, I mean, for some reason we immediately associate British accent with fantasy. So there's nothing to say that it has to be that like that.
Right.
So you could, you know, almost do like a hybrid, combine certain elements, using some of the modern stuff to bring them into the story with, you know, using some of the, I guess, the faux accents or some slang that's kind of related to this fantasy world or science fiction world to kind of give it a bit of gravitas.
Yeah, well, I mean, the idea is to bring more realism to the story by having it relate to the characters more. But obviously, if what you're saying is going to take away from that realism, then you're going a bit too far.
Mm.
One of the things that I think helps make Stephen King's stories much more realistic is that the characters seem realistic, as we said before. But one of the things that he does for that is give them flaws. And this actually comes into the next point that we're going to talk about, which is fine lines. Kind of fine line between... Actually, what is this fine line between?
Like sanity and sanity.
Okay.
Fine line between cruel, like mundane cruelty and out and out evil.
And supernatural and natural. So he often gives his characters these great flaws. Again, for example, Tommyknockers, the main character in that, he's got a metal plate in his head and he's a drug addict and a drunk. Not at all a very Superman kind of character. But I think that's really helpful, especially in this kind of genre where the characters are very human, they're very vulnerable, and they have big problems. And I think that's something that you can use to make your games more realistic, is that give your characters a flaw. You know, you may have built, to use D&D for example, this great fighter who's got all these great perks, but, you know, D&D doesn't have a hindrance system. But why not add something to that? Give him some piece of kryptonite.
I see DMs everywhere writing down on their player's character sheet, "Now you guys have a metal plate in his head. There you go."
Why not?
I don't know. That's a good point. I think, and we've had this discussion before, maybe the reason, or is the reason, that this makes characters seem more realistic or makes the story more compelling is because those flaws arguably make the characters weaker and kind of a little bit powerless. And we've discussed before how one of the core ideas of horror is that the protagonists are much more powerless than in an adventure or an action story.
Yeah, that was what we said. The characters can control their destiny that or win, then it's an action movie. Otherwise, it's a horror movie.
Right, and so what I'm getting at is giving those character flaws, is that a way of making them powerless?
It's definitely an element of it. I mean, Achilles may have been a great hero, but he had his Achilles heel, and that's what made him more of a memorable character.
I also thought it was clever because he did a lot of stuff, too, but...
No, it had nothing to do with it.
Was Achilles in Carrie?
No, Christine.
It's also good to play a character on the edge like that. I mean, if you're looking at somebody with the, like in The Shining, and they're struggling to maintain what they have, I mean, sometimes, you know, I don't want to pick on Riffs because we've done it before, but in Riffs...
Isn't like picking on Riffs like trying to like, I don't know, enter a boxing match with a one-on person?
Are you speaking down of Riffs after you get onto the topic of Riffs is like swallowing after you take a bite of food.
But, you know, they have the crazies, or you look at the Vampire, they have the Malkavians in the Requiem. They've kind of incorporated that into the Ventru, where you kind of play these characters that are close to the edge of insanity. Mm-hmm. But, like, really play that edge. I mean, that's what makes you... And sometimes you lose that battle. And you could get certain assistance in the form of, like, alcohol or drugs. And not saying that you have to incorporate that in your game if that's going to make people feel uncomfortable. But, I mean, it could be a cursed sword. Mm-hmm. You know, it's always, like, kind of teasing you, talking to you, making you crazy. Maybe it's not even cursed. It's just all in your head.
Maybe it's offering you drugs. I don't know. Come on. Yeah, one more drink. You can handle it. I'm glad you brought that up, because I was thinking, it's, to me, yeah, it would be great if a player played a character on the edge, or, you know, with one of those really fine lines between sanity and insanity, or a couple of the other ones we're going to discuss, but... Sometimes I get the feeling it might be like, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. You can tell the players that this is kind of the character you want, or this would make a really compelling character in a story, but ultimately, I would say it's up to the player to do that. Like, as the DM, I don't think you can really force anyone to do that.
Well, I mean, first is like, if you're going to play somebody like that as a player, play it. I mean, it's boring. Just to play, like, the Uber killing machine, and if you look at Riffs, or...
Again? Yeah. Jeez, kick it while it's down, why
or
don't
no,
you?
Because I did say the crazies, so just to refer back to that. And in the Malkavians, you're like, well, why else did you pick that character? Mm-hmm. If not to explore that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's common in writing to say that dynamic characters are better than static characters, infinitely better. So... Even if you want to play a good guy, maybe start him off with some of these problems and try to work him through them, you know, and grow as a character.
Grow downwardly.
Well, I mean, that's actually one way to do it. You could place a guy who starts out squeaky clean and goes closer towards that edge, or somebody who goes over the edge and has to try and pull themselves back onto the other end of it.
And you could do it, like, you give them really difficult choices. If anybody wants to see an amazing movie that is related to Stephen King, watch.
Oh, good. Better than my Achilles example.
Yeah, Sound of Music. I mean, really, I mean, what can you... No, I mean, watch The Mist, and there you see what the protagonist is forced to deal with, and it's like, that's a great thing to play with, and, you know, kind of, is he going to lose it, you know? This is a normal person who's, you know, was never really on the edge before, but now he's on the edge because of this story.
Yeah.
So, and it could be the edge is like, sometimes you see those movies, to deviate a little bit from Stephen King, where, you know, it's just that one night and there's all this crazy stuff happens and, you know, it's just physically exhausting, and that becomes emotionally exhausting and mentally exhausting. So you can simulate that. Unfortunately, RPGs have a tendency to, like, once the action starts, everything to kind of drag to the halt.
Yeah.
Right.
As everybody pulls up the rule books and the dice.
But, you know, maybe deal with the aftermath of that combat, the aftermath of the action. You know, it's far too common a thing where after you go through an action scene, you know, you take a 5-minute rest and your character's back up to full hit points or full vitality or whatever.
Yeah, well, yeah, then cut down the action scenes and just have a lot of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't need, like, somebody with 50 hit points if it would be better to have 10 people with 5.
Exactly.
Hmm. I was actually wondering, like, that made me think, could you cut out, like, combat altogether? Kind of the interesting part is, like, the choices you have to make. Could, you know, you really, really compress combat into, like, you know, a description, maybe a single die roll?
Well, you could...
For some players, yes. Others, no.
Well, yeah, all right.
It depends. I mean, if you did something like the video game Snake Eater, Metal Gear Solid something. I don't know. I played it for, like, an hour. So I guess it didn't grip me, but...
Sounds riveting, yeah.
Yeah, the premise gripped me in that you try to just avoid combat. And that's where all the tension comes in. Or if you make it so that, I mean, there's those Japanese shows where the, what are they called? The Hunters?
Oh, yeah, I love those shows.
Yeah, and they get some sort of, like, B-list celebrities, and they run around, like, an amusement park or something like that, and they're chased by these guys who kind of look like the Terminator meets Agent Smith.
Yeah.
And they chase the person around, or chase the celebrities around. But, yeah, once they catch them, they catch them. It's over. It's done. Mm-hmm. And you could do that. It's like, there's not really going to be any combat, because once they catch you, it's done. It's all about It's all about evasion. Now, if the guy built a combat monster, then he's going to be a little bit miffed.
I don't know. Maybe that's the time where, you know, you actually do a little bit of combat, and the guy gets really messed up, and you're like, yeah, well, you were the combat monster, and you barely escaped, so what does that say about the game? Don't try it again.
Yeah. Or if you have a game system where there's some kind of injury system, you know, where maybe it's going to take you a long time to get back to being the combat monster. So now, instead of the rest of the group relying on you during combat, you have to rely on them somewhat. Deal with it. That sounds jerky, doesn't it? Deal with it.
No more jerky than Lyle's. Hey, you know what? I want to say it. Role play in a role-playing game.
Dang you and your common sense.
Yeah, sometimes it has to be said, you know?
Yeah. But obviously, I think, and just like anything, if you overdo it, I don't think anybody would want to read Cujo 2 or Cujo 3. It's like, stay out of the car, come on.
Right.
Nobody found you, you know?
This may not be the best example of it, but, you know, Cujo is a way that you could look at the opposite of that, too. You know, you start with a squeaky clean Goody Two-Shoes character, and then they have a great fall. Maybe not quite as far as Cujo, where they turn into the villain of the book.
You realize Cujo is a dog, right?
Yes, thank you very much. That's why I said it's probably not the best example, but it's the one that came to mind.
The squeaky clean dog. Yeah,
but
no,
I mean, that's
prison
the way
record.
The book is. This Cujo starts out as a very loved, you know, friendly family pet, and by the end, he's quite the opposite. But I mean, that's something that you could play with as a character, someone who's experienced a fall from grace. And are they trying to get back into it, or have they turned away from it, or have they got rabies?
I think some other examples are if you read The Stand and you see people who are then put in an extraordinary situation, and they essentially have to go one of two ways. But to watch the fall of some of the characters, it is pretty interesting how they do that. And it comes from like some pretty petty stuff, pretty realistic stuff. That kind of leads them that way. Yeah, of course, we mentioned The Shining as well.
Yeah, you see the guy just go crazy over the course of the book. Another one might be, actually, I just thought of because of what you were saying, Lyle, Needful Things, the difference between civilization and chaos. This curiosity shop starts tempting people, and pretty soon the whole town just falls apart.
Or the ultimate revenge fantasy of the Carrie, and just, you know, what kind of sets her off, and, you know, bullying is a big thing now. Well, always was, but I don't know if it's gotten worse or...
Those kids with their online social medias.
Yeah. There is that one story in Canada where the girl just killed herself.
Yeah,
I
read about
that. I heard Anonymous, like, revealed who the guy was. I guess they do good things. Anonymous, though.
not the bully.
Don't worry, I didn't think you were referring to
the online
bullies.
Predator. Yeah.
So then they brought this all up, like, yeah, the journey is much more interesting than the destination in this case. So,
nice.
Again, is that kind of the player's responsibility or impetus or the DM's?
Well,
or GM's?
I understand your question, but I kind of see it as a both. It's a collaborative process.
Well, that's obviously the correct answer. It was more of a rhetorical one. You know,
I want something wrong.
Yeah.
Oh, was this the journey to that answer?
Exactly.
We're going to consider a 5-minute journey for the obvious answer.
In this case, perhaps the journey was not as interesting as the destination. All right.
Yeah, they were like, it's a collaboration. Oh, they're still talking. No, maybe it's a different answer. Oh, it is a collaboration. Oh, thanks, guys.
I think the impetus is largely on the player, because it would be rude for the DM to just kind of slap this on their players. So let the player come up with something that they want to do, but be supportive as a DM. Yeah.
All right. You shall heal no argument from me, sir.
All right, so the other theme is, and this kind of relates in, you know, on the edge. One of the reasons why some people are on the edge is because of some childhood trauma, and Chris mentioned about, like, some flaws. And a lot of the fears in the Stephen King books come from, like, childhood fears. Some very explicit, like It, where it is children and, you know, antagonist is a clown.
Yep.
Tommyknockers came from a children's rhyme that he knew.
Yeah. And then, of course, there was his own, like, fears when he was growing up and things that he read. Now there's different things you can do with that.
Yeah, I was just going to say that I think that one of the reasons Stephen King is such a successful horror writer is because he uses these childhood fears. And I think that's maybe something to think about if you want to create a campaign or a game that is horrific in some way, is don't go overly complicated. Fear is a pretty simplistic emotion. And some of the most basic things that frighten us the most are the things that, you know, we're born with, like fears of snakes and spiders, for example. Yeah, use those kinds of things.
That's a good point.
Thank you.
Because, I mean, it actually relates to what we're talking about at the beginning of the episode when we're talking about Spectre, Wraith, and Ghost. And a game like D&D, because it has to, and because of the nature of the game, has kind of like parsed these monsters into all these different parts and sub-monster. So there's, yeah. You know, so instead of having like, you know, one entry for Ghost, you have, you know, 10 entries. Then you release, you know, Monster Manual 2, 3, 4, and you want to add, you know, more ghosts or whatever, different versions of...
Gotta catch them all.
Well, yeah, it's like, I didn't even know there were that many metals in the world, but when you read all those dragons, you're like, oh, really? Okay. And you're like, copper and bronze? Really, guys? We're going to have to, like, the difference between those two dragons?
Yeah, right.
But, like, Stephen King would just be, no, it's a dragon. What were you afraid of a dragon as a kid, you know?
Exactly.
You know, it's a ghost. What kind of ghost? Doesn't matter. One that doesn't like you. Yeah. Yeah, no, so they keep, sometimes keeping it really, really simple. And again, yeah, it gets back to that point the guy raised in that article is that, you know, players don't want the DM to say, this is a revenant.
Mm.
Oh, a revenant specter hybrid. And you're like, oh, okay. Well, there's the mystery gone. It's just like, you know, you see a spirit and you're like, you don't even care. You know what a spirit, how it makes you feel. If you were really going to see that.
Yeah, and if your players are immersed, if they're invested in the stories, they might even feel the fear for real. And oh, that's when a game gets awesome.
That brings me up to exactly what I was going to ask. And like with these childhood fears, are you trying to scare the character, or are you trying to make the player uncomfortable?
Well, I don't know. Like, if let's say an example. So if you're a party of, I don't know, if you're in a starship and there's a rabid dog out in space. Not so scary.
I just now have this idea of like a dog, you know, frozen. No, I have like this idea of like a frozen dog bumping up against the thing. You know?
It was rabbit.
Ah, jeez.
He finally gets up to you, but he can't bite through a space helmet.
So clearly that was for the players. But what you could combine that. I mean, sure, keep it simple, but also you have to incorporate these childhood fears into whatever world you have. Mm-hmm. So let's say you're playing werewolf. Just because of the dog thing, I was thinking about that. So, yeah, you have a disease like rabies.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, or it could be cooties. Sorry.
Oh, now I'm scared.
Do I have to remind you, Lyle, this is the month of horror?
Sorry. No, actually, probably the funniest joke on King of the Hill ever was Bobby, the little boy, he's going to a party. And it's like boys and girls, and I think maybe they've been calling it a kissing party. So Hank, the father, is like, oh, my Bobby's going to his first kissing party. Maybe he'll get cooties. And Bobby's like, what's that? Oh, it's the kissing disease. And Bobby goes, you mean like chlamydia? So you incorporate like elements. So it's like a rabid werewolf, like part of your pack. One of them has caught something and has gone rabid.
Yeah.
So you're kind of helpless, you know, even though, yeah, but it, you know, it's within your world, but maybe he's a little bit stronger and you're kind of trapped in that closed space and you can't get out.
Mm-hmm.
Or a clown. Clowns are scary in any setting. You know?
Werewolf clown.
Pretty easy, you know, the fear of being alone. That's so useful in a game. If you have a game where it's a dangerous game, perhaps D&D isn't a good example of this, but something where it's more like GURPS, where you can die very quickly, and your character is alone in a dangerous situation. That scares you. You don't want your character to die.
When you're a kid, you're afraid of being different as well.
Mm. Very good one, yeah.
Yes, like the Dead Zone, Carrie, all of those things. They're like, you know, different people having tough times. And, you know, yeah, you are really afraid as a kid. You want to be the same. So you have something where that difference is really dangerous.
Listen to you guys articulate that. I would probably try to target the player's fear, you know, play up on the common childhood fears of possibly clowns yeah, as you said, fear of being different, fear of being, you know, left alone, and other ones that kind of everybody has to some degree, rather than targeting something their character has.
That's good, Wayne. I mean, I think that's a really good idea, but I wonder if getting that information from your players might not give the game away, because not knowing, or the mystery, the unknown part of fear is one of the things that makes it fearsome.
Well, that's why I kind of would go with the quote-unquote common ones, you know, that everybody feels to some degree.
Yeah,
you know,
and that's what Secret of Stephen King's success.
Yeah. I mean, I almost kind of saw it like, you know, taking a pot of spaghetti and just throwing it at the wall and seeing what sticks, you know?
Yeah, are you throwing a pot of spaghetti, or are you like actual spaghetti noodles? Spaghetti
sauce included.
Yes.
I'm going to scare you. Blah, have some spaghetti. No, I meant like, in terms of what fears to pick, just do a bunch of them and then see which ones cause reactions. I don't mean all at once, you know, but like over the course of several sessions, present these different situations and see how players react. And then that might give it away a little bit, but if you do it subtly enough, you could maybe figure out what pushes whose buttons a little bit and then use that later on.
Yeah.
Like, since you talked about kids, right, and this is childhood fears, what do you actually think about playing a session as kid before starting whatever campaign you're going to run?
I think your players might not like it, as happened to me.
It depends on the...
That was...
Go ahead, Mike.
Sorry, I was going to say that was different because we were not playing our own characters as children. We were playing children we didn't know, arguably we had no attachment to.
Depends on the story, yeah. I mean, if it's something where something horrible happened when you were kids, 20 years later, then just some consequences, then yeah, go ahead. If you want to tell a story where you want to show why you guys are all together and you got together as kids, then yeah, sure.
Yeah, specifically kind of thinking of it with that.
I think that playing parts of characters' backgrounds live, even if your characters didn't know each other in the background, allow them to take over roles of other roles in the background. And I think children is a great way to go with that. I think there's a lot of great stories to be told playing kids.
Yeah, my only caution would be that the players might be, okay, let's hurry up and get back to the real story.
True, true.
So I think maybe experiment a bit and maybe have, like, you know, the one session prologue. And then, you know, if they really like that, then that's something that you can incorporate more. Maybe you split the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking about using games like Grimm, for example, where you play kids and then do a couple sessions of that, or even like a campaign of that, and then go, okay, you know, and now make your adult self based on that character, and then doing something with that.
You know, I've never tried Grimm before, or for that matter, having played as a kid, and I think I would really like to. I could see it being a really freeing experience. You know,
you just don't want any consequences, do you?
No, kids face consequences, and especially if you put them in a horrific world or a world like Grimm, that's fine. When we played Monster Hearts, it was a lot of fun because we were playing characters that didn't have emotional maturity yet. It was a bit different because they were teenagers, so it was just kind of emotional overdrive. But that was still a lot of fun to play that kind of character. And playing kids could also be a lot really enjoyable, I imagine.
Yeah, no, it could be good. Yeah, some players will really run with it. Some players will be really silly with it, which could be a bit annoying for the other players. Yeah, like, they could exaggerate it. Well, fittingly, we're going to end on the final theme, which is going to be endings. And the kind of endings Stephen King had, I guess. Well, we're just going to end on that word, apparently.
with a whimper.
I think, especially in his early work, one thing I liked about the Stephen King books, and I think Chris is going to disagree with me, is that they kind of end with a resolution, and then you turn the page and you find out things aren't as resolved as you thought.
Yeah, I said it before the episode, yeah, I kind of have a love-hate relationship with a lot of Stephen King's stories. I think a lot of the endings seem to just come out of nowhere. Some of them are kind of deus ex machina, and sometimes they just don't really make much sense. But that said, a lot of the stories he does that, where the ending just kind of blows into the room without any warning, and it works really well. For example, Christine, I think, is an example of it working very well, where the story resolves itself, and then at the very end, actually, no, that'll be a spoiler. I'm gonna not go into that. Christine has a good ending. Where the opposite. Sorry. Read the book. It's good. The opposite is, Children of the Corn, which has, it's very nonsensical. It's a really good kind of psychological horror thriller all the way through, where everything seems to exist in a very mundane world, albeit, you know, filled with murder and blood and horror and all that stuff. But at the very end, all of a sudden, monsters and demons seem to spring out of nowhere, and it kind of takes a bit away from the story. But that said, it's been a very rare occasion where I haven't enjoyed the actual reading of the story itself, even if the ending is a little odd.
Well, what I would hope people can take away from it is if they read a story like Carrie or Christine or Pet Sematary, and you can see how you can like finish a story and then kind of give hints of a little more. And whether or not you choose to explore that, because maybe the players are done with that story, you know, or that type of story. Yeah. But if they kind of bite on that hint or those little hooks, then they can get a bit more out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can kind of force it on them a little bit later, not immediately afterwards. They can move on to a different story, and then something can come back. It's not a spoiler when we talk about It, because we've already mentioned that part of the book is them as kids and part of them as adults. So obviously they're not spending the adult time doing mundane things. They're dealing with the problem that they dealt with as kids. So you could, revisit that a little bit later.
Last thing with the ending, like, isn't the abrupt ending, and then sometimes isn't, like, the unresolved ending, don't those work both to, like, the horror a little bit, especially the unresolved ending? I don't know, it's kind of like that moment at the end of the movie where you think, oh, great.
Where the hand bursts out of the grave?
Well, yeah, like that. It's over, and no, it's not, you know? That's part of why it's scary.
And I respect Stephen King's writing for it. You know, his books are, as much as they are about the story, they're also about the ending. And he comes up with some very, very interesting endings. Even if I don't always agree how they work. It's cool. So yeah, it's all about the endings. And that's the way I like to build my games too, is I think the ending should be something special. Even though it doesn't always work for me either.
Well, of course, with a game, the tough thing is that you can't necessarily plan how things end.
Exactly.
But, you know, saying that, I know that, again, classic advice is, like, don't plan the ending, but, you know, everybody does. And, you know, you buy a module, it has an ending.
Right.
And kind of the unspoken agreement in a lot of games is, hey, guys, we're going to work towards this ending.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to get there somehow, but we're going to do this ending, you know.
You're going to get there even if the railroad you.
Yep.
Right.
But all aboard!
Like, all aboard the plot train. No, but I was going to say, like, you're right. We always say, like, or lots of people say, don't plan an ending because then, you know, that kind of railroads a player and forces them and constrains them. But that being said, oftentimes when you're planning out the story and you come up with a scenario or a situation, many people say, okay, if the players don't intervene, this is what's going to happen. This is how things are going to end. When you come up with, like, NPCs, you say, this is what's going to happen to those NPCs. You know, this is maybe the end of this NPC story, or this is how the situation is going to resolve itself if the players don't act. And sometimes people even plan, okay, well, if something like this happens, then the situation is going to resolve like this. You know, maybe they'll make, like, a flow chart or a diagram for themselves. So, when you say kind of don't plan the ending, but I think most people kind of do anyway. They're just open to having it change.
Yeah, I don't think I could plan a game without accidentally thinking of the ending, even just in my spare time while thinking about the game.
I just think how meta would it be if we just ended the episode there. Sure.
Alright, well, thank you for joining us again on Idle Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idleredhands.com, idleredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website or download it off of DriveThruRPG, listen to it through Stitcher or through iTunes. You can also post in our forums, post a comment right there on the webpage. You can follow us on Twitter or check us out on Facebook, or even just send us an email, because we always love hearing from you. See you later and stay spooky.
Bye.
Bye.
DriveThruRPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week, and we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. DriveThruRPG, the one true source for RPGs. We'll be right back.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.